Thank you, Ambassador. Distinguished audience, let me begin by thanking the organizers for giving me an opportunity to be here and talk to all of you about a very topical and important issue at the moment for Malaysia and for many other countries. So what I'm going to present today is my paper on the CPTPP implications for Malaysia's merchandise trade balance as well as digital industrialization. I think we have not discussed too much on digital industrialization, but there's also a need to keep that in mind that Industry 4.0 is here. So in that context also, we can have more detailed discussions as we go on. So to this audience, I don't think I need to explain what CPTPP is. But let's just refresh ourselves in terms of looking at Malaysia's trade balance and trade pattern. As we know, Malaysia has always been a net exporter of merchandise products. So Malaysia's trade balance, merchandise trade balance, has always been positive. While Malaysia has always faced a negative trade balance in services. So this makes it even more important for Malaysia to have a positive and to sustain a positive trade balance in merchandise trade. If you look at the merchandise trade balance, what we find is that it is steadily going down. From $34 billion in 2009, it has gone down to $23 billion. So this does, pose some kind of a worry, because if in services trade you don't have a positive balance and in merchandise trade your trade balance is going down, that can be worrisome for the economy. So in this context, how will CPTPP affect exports and imports, especially merchandise exports and imports of Malaysia? So this has been the context of the paper. I know there have been a lot of studies on TPP and some studies on CPTPP as well. I would just like to, I would say caution all of you, the policymaker and the industry, in terms of when you are looking at a study, it is extremely important to understand the methodology. You know, wherever I go, in whichever country, I talk to the policymakers and I talk to the industry and I tell them, if you don't understand the logic of the methodology, then it is rubbish. It is not because you have limited understanding. You know your business much more than anyone else, and the government knows the economy much more than anyone else. But the methodology should be something which appeals to your common sense and your logic. Now, there have been some studies which have used CGE modeling. While the economic literature has heavily criticize CGE modeling, you will not find very top journals publishing papers which use CGE modeling. The policymakers have been relying a lot on CGE modeling. I just want to highlight few assumptions of CGE models and see if that appeals to your logic. One is the assumption of full employment of labor and capital everywhere in the world. I wish. The second is government budgets always remain balanced. That means if governments lose tariff revenue, they can always make up their, or they can keep their budgets balanced by raising the income tax. I don't know which government in the world has that flexibility of raising your income taxes if they lose out on tariff revenue. Third is all products are unique. That means consumer can never substitute palm oil of Indonesia with Malaysian palm oil. So that kind of, no substitution or perfect substitutes do not exist. That kind of assumption is there in the model. And then the studies have talked about non-tariff measures, and they have said if 50%, there is a reduction of 50% in NTMs, there will be a substantial rise in GDP. Now the question is, I don't know if you people are aware, when they say reduction in NTMs, it is not in other countries or in other markets. It is NTMs in your own markets. So you reduce your own NTMs and then your GDP will increase. First, how many governments can do that? NTMs, what kind of NTMs? There are these schemes to which benefit SMEs, which benefit small producers. They may be your incentives, but they are NTMs for other countries. Can you reduce that by 50%? How do you measure that? How do you reduce that? Do you really want to do it? NTMs have some very positive effect in terms of generating employment, in terms of, you know, giving incentives for a particular sector. So do you really want to reduce your NTMs? Other thing, if you're out of CPTPP or any regional trade agreements, if those countries reduce their NTMs, they can't do it just for limited number of countries. Because if you reduce your standards, it will be for all countries. So you can have the benefits of reduced NTMs in other markets even without joining the trade agreement. So if this logic doesn't appeal to anyone of you, we can have further discussion on it. So it's extremely important to see what methodology the studies are applying. If you really want to depend on the results of the study to take policy decisions and as important policy decision as CPTPP. Just looking at Malaysia's tariffs vis-a-vis CPTPP 10 countries, we find that Malaysia's tariffs are higher. Whichever way you try to estimate, applied duties, simple average, bound duties, weighted average, you find that compared to CPTPP 10 countries, the average tariff of Malaysia is higher. That means Malaysia will be liberalizing more compared to other 10 countries if a trade agreement takes place or Malaysia ratifies it. Now, the methodology that I have used in my study is a very simple methodology. It's available online. It's called Smart Simulation. You just type that. It is available online. Anyone or every one of you can download the model, give tariff simulation, and you'll get the same results. There is no monopoly over the model. So it is downloadable. There is a very simple logic. The model uses price elasticities and supply elasticities. So if tariff goes down, what will be the impact on prices? How will that affect demand? And given the supply capacity, how will that affect countries' exports and imports? So it is straightforward methodology. The strong point of this methodology is that it is the only model which gives you results at a very disaggregated level. While CG model talks about, you know, increase in imports of agricultural products, this model will tell you increase in exports of rice, not just rice, broken rice. So if you really want to look at, you know, what your where the imports are going to increase, where are the exports going to increase, this will give you very disaggregated six-digit level with the HS code so that you can play around in terms of building incentives or having mitigation effects, whatever, you know, or making your sensitive list vis-a-vis trade agreement. So this is a model which is very much used by policymakers when they want to assess trade agreements' impact. And using this model, what the results of this model shows that if Malaysia, the impact of on Malaysia of CPTPP will be increase in imports of $2.5 billion. And this model also gives you what will be the new imports and what will be the trade diversion. New imports is trade creation. That means because of tariffs going down, the cost going down, there will be more demand for the same product. So it's a new demand coming in. And trade diversion means that instead of importing it from outside, now you import it from the partner countries of CPTPP and you're diverting your trade. So there is no new imports, but this is existing imports, but new partner. The result shows that the maximum rise of imports will be from Japan. And the top five products where the imports will rise is vehicles, plastic and articles thereof, machinery, mechanical appliances, electric machinery and equipment, and iron and steel. I've given broad sectors, but if you look at the annex of the paper, your six-digit codes of these products are given where and how much imports will rise is there. I can also, in addition to this, I can also give you from which country, which product, but it wasn't possible to put that kind of matrix in the paper, but that information is there. Imports of vehicles will increase by 36%, and mainly cars are, the code is 870323 and 870324, and mainly from Japan. This will lead to higher imports of plastic waste and scrap. That is the HS code for plastic waste and scrap, which the imports increase by 35% from Japan, Singapore, and Australia. So this is the kind of table you will find in the paper. I have aggregated it to 2-digit, but at 6-digit codes, you will get all the results. Now, what happens to Malaysia's exports? We know Malaysia already has existing trade agreements with its major trading partner within CPTPP, that is Japan, Singapore, and Australia. Almost 82% and 84% is Malaysia's imports and exports to these three countries. And if CPTPP is ratified, this will lead to an increase in imports of 6%, that is 2.5 billion, but exports rise only by 0.2%. And this is because of the already existing trade agreements with the big trading partners. But we have to understand that, you know, Malaysia, when Malaysia had free trade agreement with these countries, it had a sensitive list. But in CPTPP, that doesn't, is no longer there. So, this is where the exports, how the exports will increase. Exports to Canada increases by 2.6%, Vietnam 2.2%, in total 0.2%. Exports to Australia declines because of trade diversion, because Australia will then start importing from whoever is more competitive within the CPTPP countries. And it is seen that Australia's imports from Malaysia declines by 0.6%. This is the product-wise percentage change in exports. So your exports rises of wood and articles of wood. Furniture, 0.7%. For others, it's 0.01 or something. But you don't see much gains in terms of exports. So what happens to merchandise trade balance? We know that imports are rising by $2.5 billion. Exports are not rising too much, so the change in balance of trade is going to be minus $2.4 billion, and this is per annum. What happens if Malaysia does not join CPTPP? We know that then those countries, the rest of the countries, will start the trade among themselves. So there could be some trade diversion away from Malaysia within that group, and we find that this is how it will look like. Malaysia loses around $53 million if it does not join CPTPP, which is 0.09% of the existing trade balance. So if you compare what will be Malaysia's trade balance if it joins CPTPP and if it doesn't ratify CPTPP, you find that this is how it will look. Your trade balance does not change too much if you don't join, but yes, there is a drastic fall in the trade balance if Malaysia joins the trade agreement. Again, as I mentioned, that this is the reason why this is happening is that Malaysia already has FTAs with Singapore, Japan, and Australia. The three countries account for 82% and 84% of Malaysia's exports and imports. Malaysia has higher import tariffs as compared to other CPTPP countries, like I showed in my slide, which means that the tariff revenue loss to Malaysia will also be higher. So when you reduce your tariff revenue loss is there, and this has been estimated to be around $0.6 billion per annum, which is, this is how in different product categories, tariff revenue loss will materialize. So when you look at, in conclusion, the impact on trade balance, we find that the trade balance impact is not very encouraging. Associated trade balance of Malaysia will fall by 2.4 billion if Malaysia ratifies, which is 13% of its existing trade balance. And if it does not ratify, the trade balance falls by 0.2% of existing trade balance. But here I also want to bring out one more aspect which I don't think has been really discussed and talked, and that is industry 4.0. What is happening in the digital industrial revolution is that the digital content of industrial production is rising in the developed countries, mainly in the developed countries, and if you, including China, which is not a developed country. But if you start, I have a paper on this growing trade in electronic transmissions, which really talks about the implications on different developing countries. And I have, in declining order, I have looked at which country is adding domestic digital value in their manufacturing exports, and I find the highest is in China, followed by US and something like $25 billion and then $20 billion. But when you go down and you find Malaysia is less than even $5 billion, even $1 billion. So that is where Malaysia is really lagging behind other developed countries and many developing countries as well in terms of adding digital content in their manufacturing exports. This may not show up right now in terms of your broad aggregate indicators like ICT Development Index. You might find Malaysia is ranking high in ICT Development Index, but digital infrastructure goes much beyond ICT infrastructure. It includes data infrastructure. And today, data is the new oil. Many people use it, not really giving the context or understanding the context. The context is when the first industrial revolution happened, it was not the oil producing countries which benefited, but it was the oil using and oil processing countries which benefited, who were able to industrialize. Similarly, in this digital revolution, we are all producing data. But countries who are producing data are not the ones who are going to benefit. Countries who process data are the ones who are going to benefit. And CPTPP have many provisions, I think Sanya will also highlight them, which will not encourage data processing in Malaysia, because data localization is not allowed in CPTPP, which means that foreign firms will try to store your data. They can take your data because Malaysia doesn't own their data. Malaysia doesn't have a data policy which says Malaysia has a sovereign right over their data. So foreign firms will not ask Malaysia whether we can take your data out or not. They will store it wherever it is less costly, which most probably will be Japan. And then it will be very difficult for Malaysia to build their data infrastructure, their data centers, their digital skills, to have big data analytics. It will be extremely difficult to progress in the digital revolution or in the digital era. Another thing, I just want to take 2 more minutes over here. There is this zero custom duties on electronic transmission. This is a binding commitment in CPTPP. Now, you know data is the heart of digital revolution. Software is the brain of digital revolution. Both data and software are electronically transmitted. They don't physically cross border. That means if you agree that you will never have custom duties on electronic transmission, this means foreign firm can be in their home countries, electronically transmit a software, which can be used in 3D printing, to print so many products, shoes, clothes, mechanical appliances, electric appliances, and you have no control over that, because you are not applying custom duties, you are allowing them to, and then you lose out on FDI. How do you encourage FDI? How do you tell FDI to come into your country and invest so that you can have employment generation, you can have better technology? You can't do that, because foreign firms now physical presence is another thing I want to point out over here. We all think 3D printing is, somewhere in distant future and it's a niche market. There is the latest technology in 3D printing, which is called latent splintering technology, where a 3D printer can 3D print 100,000 units 100 times faster than a machine. So we are talking about customized products being mass produced, and it is customized because it is based on the data which Malaysia does not own, data which Malaysia does not process. And those are the softwares which you cannot control. You cannot say, I don't want this software which will 3D print this, because you have signed CPTPP and you have no control. You have taken binding commitments that we will never put any custom duties or control over data flowing out or software coming in to 3D print. So I think we might negotiate tariffs. We might sit and try to assess the implications of bringing our tariffs down to zero. But tomorrow, tariffs will not be relevant. Whatever you negotiate in GATT or GATS or in bilateral or regional trade agreements, they will not be relevant as more and more products digitalize and are electronically transmitted, on which no custom duties countries have taken binding commitments on no custom duties. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for including us in this and managing to organize it at such short notice, and to all of you for making time to come. So we have limited time, and of course the CPTPP is a very long document, so I won't go through, say, the Malaysian laws, regulations and policies that may need to be changed if Malaysia ratifies the CPTPP, the Treasury circulars, the competition law and so on, but I'm happy to discuss with anyone who is interested. I also won't cover the impact on, say, Malaysian farmers and fisher folk and state and local governments or regulators, but we can talk about that if you're interested. I thought I would focus on the impact on Malaysian businesses, in addition to what Dr. Bunga covered in terms of the imports and exports and so on. And of course, I'm not a negotiator. I wasn't in the room when the CPTPP was negotiated, so there are some ambiguities in the provisions which might be clarified by the negotiating history, but since I wasn't in the room, I don't have that. I will say that I was very impressed at the extent of the exceptions that the Malaysian government obtained in the CPTPP, which were more extensive than other US free trade agreements that I've seen, including for government procurement and some of the non-conforming measures and so on. So, of course, you know that the CPTPP has 30 chapters, and those in bold are the ones that you might think of as being part of a traditional trade agreement about trade in goods, imports and exports, as Dr. Bunga was talking about. Then the other 24 CPTPP chapters are other things, including your behind-the-border domestic laws and so on, whether it's intellectual property or competition laws or government-linked companies and so on. And then the chapters towards the end that look positive, like cooperation, business facilitation, development, small and medium enterprises, those chapters unfortunately are unenforceable and don't have things like new aid to Malaysian SMEs to help them meet the standards in Japan, or for Malaysian farmers to meet the standards on pesticides levels that Japan sets and so on. Of course, as you know, the CPTPP only temporarily suspends 22 of the more than 1,000 provisions that were in the original TPP. Some of the provisions which were temporarily suspended are some of the key ones that the US insisted on, including longer patents on medicines, monopolies on medicines even when it's not patented, some of the investor-to-state dispute settlement provisions on the margins and so on. But of course, those can be unsuspended at any time, especially if the CPTPP countries want to encourage the US to come back. And of course, the US could also ask for additional things. But if, for example, the provision on biologics exclusivity was unsuspended, these medicines are the new medicines, often treatments for cancer, complex medicines, or vaccines. Some of these cost about $400,000 per patient per year at the monopoly price, and you have to take them for life, some of them. And these medicines are not so new that they deserve a patent, because today biologics, the state of science, is not enough that we can design from scratch a new biological compound. We have to adapt an existing one. So if you remember insulin for diabetics, we used to extract it from pigs. Now we can make a synthetic version. But we didn't design an insulin molecule from scratch. So these molecules are arguably not new or inventive enough to deserve a patent. So if they're not patented, Malaysia could get the biosimilar, the more affordable biosimilar, whether from India or from Malaysia, and you wouldn't have to pay $400,000 per patient per year. But if that provision is unsuspended in the CPTPP, it's a monopoly for 5 years, even when there is no patent, 5 years at which you pay the $400,000 price. And to give you an example of the change in price when there is competition, if you remember, HIV/AIDS medicines used to be $15,000 per patient per year. When that patent expired and we had generic competition, the same medicine is now $67 per patient per year. So, and Malaysia, of course, had the experience with hepatitis C and the compulsory license that enabled Malaysia to import the cheaper generic version and treat the 500,000 Malaysians with hepatitis C and, in fact, cure them. So, of course, those provisions are temporarily suspended but could be unsuspended if the parties so agree. So just looking at some of the other provisions which can affect Malaysian businesses, I thought I would start with export taxes. Malaysia has taxes on exports of raw materials and a number of commodities. And I heard from the Associated Chinese Chambers of Commerce and Industry in Malaysia about the success of the Malaysian wooden furniture industry and how many people it employs here. And they told me that they are dependent on the export tax on timber, logs, leaving Malaysia. Because if those logs go out, and Malaysia has to pay the world market price for timber, Malaysia's competitiveness in wooden furniture disappears. So today, the wooden furniture industry is very competitive. It can export. It's mostly 80 to 90% SMEs. because of the export taxes on timber. The general rule in the CPTPP is that there cannot be export taxes on any product to other CPTPP parties. Malaysia and Vietnam got exceptions for a certain list of products, but only to the listed levels. So Malaysia currently has export bans on logs, which is not necessarily legal. So if Malaysia converted those to export taxes, to make an equivalent to an export ban, it would have to be very high. And are the export taxes that are allowed in the CPTPP allowed to a level that is high enough to substitute for the export ban to be equally effective? And Malaysia apparently has a shortage of logs already for the wooden furniture industry, the plywood industry, the processing industries, because the supply of logs is falling in Malaysia and expected to continue to fall. So if those export taxes that are allowed are not sufficient, the wooden furniture industry could be adversely affected and its ability to export to, say, Canada or Mexico or Peru. Now, of course, these restrictions on export taxes are only to other CPTPP parties, but that includes Singapore. And from Singapore, they can go to the whole world. So it can effectively remove Malaysia's export taxes on timber or limit them to the EU, the US, Russia, any other country in the world. Similarly, I spoke to the Malaysian Iron and Steel Industry Federation, and they told me that they are dependent on the export taxes on scrap metal to ensure enough of a supply for them, because most of them don't have a big enough economy of scale in Malaysia to use iron ore. Malaysia's population is generally not big enough to support that. But of course, scrap metal, everybody's searching for scrap metal, right? And so if you don't have high enough export taxes, it goes out of the country. Malaysia has to import it at the world price as an input for the very impressive Malaysian steel industry, which does things like boilers and so on at competitive world rates. So again, are the export taxes that are allowed for Malaysia allowed on enough scrap metal to high enough rates to ensure that the Malaysian steel industry that relies on it as an input can survive and thrive and flourish and take advantage of any export market access that Dr. Bunga mentioned? And then, of course, because it's an exhaustive once-and-for-all list of the export taxes that you're allowed to impose, it does not include any new export taxes you might want to put. So I think Sabah recently announced a new export tax on seafood to encourage value-added processing. I'm not clear if the export tax restrictions apply to national government only or also to state governments. That's something the negotiators here might be able to clarify. If it applies to state governments, if it's only national, then Sabah's seafood export tax is okay. But if Malaysia wanted to introduce a national seafood export tax or another kind of export tax, it's not listed in the annex, then it cannot introduce it with respect to exports to other CPTPP countries like Singapore and then to the whole world. So that's on the export tax side. And of course, it's also for the palm oil industry. I understand that at some point, both Malaysia and Indonesia built a lot of palm oil refining capacity. And those refineries may not be running at full capacity. So there's a bit of a shortage at some times of CPO and a bit of a scramble whether Malaysia gets Indonesia's CPO to process here or Indonesia gets Malaysia's CPO to process in Indonesia. And so I understand that in the past, when Indonesia raised the export tax on crude palm oil, Malaysia also had to raise to a matching level. Otherwise, all the Malaysian CPO runs to Indonesia and is refined in Indonesia with the jobs and the value-added processing and so on. Now, Indonesia is not part of the CPTPP, so they can raise their export taxes on CPO as high as they like. And of course, how big you need them to be depends on the world price of other competing commodities and so on. So if Indonesia raises them above the level that Malaysia is allowed to in the CPTPP, Malaysia would not be able to raise it to the same level to match, and Malaysia's CPO may run to Indonesia and be processed in Indonesia instead. So then we think about SMEs in the service sector. So apparently the service sector in Malaysia makes up the majority of all SMEs, and according to PricewaterhouseCoopers, they have been, the study that they did for the TPP for Malaysia, those SMEs have already been affected by Malaysia's autonomous voluntary services liberalisation, which resulted in increased competition for them and which is a major concern for them because they have not been able to grow when these sectors were liberalised. Now, of course, the CPTPP liberalises services on a negative list basis. All service sectors are liberalised except those that Malaysia managed to list in the non-conforming measures, which I understand were heavily negotiated. So I don't know if Malaysia was able to get all the exceptions they wanted. And of course, some countries in the CPTPP, like the US and Vietnam, converted the negative list to a positive list. So they said, we only liberalise the ones we've liberalised at the WTO, plus a few extra sectors. Malaysia did not convert its negative list liberalisation in services and investment to a positive list. So that means all future sectors in Malaysia are automatically liberalised. So the future Grab, Uber, Airbnb types are automatically liberalised. I'm not sure why Malaysia didn't switch to a positive list. Maybe Malaysia tried and could not succeed, or maybe it was traded off with other concessions that Malaysia got. This can have an impact, for example, in many different sectors from retail to other, and of course Malaysia's retail guidelines were largely reflected in the CPTPP, but not all of them. So there has been some additional liberalisation in the CPTPP beyond the current enforceable guidelines under the Ministry of Domestic Trade. So in the services sector, that's not the only way that SMEs could be affected. If we think about apparently Grab and Uber, if Grab got some subsidies when they were starting up from the Malaysian government, Grab is a digital product which is liberalised in the e-commerce chapter because it's a computer program. And so liberalising means non-discriminatory treatment, which means you must give national treatment, which means that in future if you wanted to subsidise the future version of Grab or whatever, you would have to subsidise the foreign version as well. You would have to give the same subsidies to Uber unless Malaysia has a non-conforming measure for that sector. And I also wanted to mention the other implications of the e-commerce chapter in the CPTPP for SMEs. This has been a concern for SMEs from other countries. SME associations from other countries have opposed these e-commerce rules because they were proposed by companies like Google, Amazon, and Facebook, who then made their proposals to the US government. The US government put them in the TPP, and nothing in the e-commerce chapter was suspended in the CPTPP. So this includes, for example, we know today that in the US, half of all online shopping searches start on Amazon.com. If somebody in the US wants to buy this cup, they don't Google this cup. Half of them go to Amazon.com and ask for coffee mugs. So if Malaysian exporters want to sell to US consumers this coffee mug, they have to sell on Amazon because that's where the consumers are, basically, right? But these platforms charge the SMEs to list their products. And the commission that they charge can be very high, up to 40%, 40% commission on sales, not profits. If you don't pay, your product is demoted down the list, or the shipping is delayed, or you get booted off the platform. So the United Nations International Trade Commission said that this is the third biggest problem for SMEs when they surveyed them, is the high commission that these platforms are charging. And they can do that because they have market power. That is where the consumers are, so the SMEs have to go there to sell. So the thing is that Amazon also makes their own products. They have the intelligence from all the companies selling on their platform, including Malaysian SMEs, and they know what is selling well. Is it this type of cup? Is it a red cup? Is it the kind of Go coffee mug that has the lid on it? Whatever sells well, Amazon then makes their own competing products. And if you search then for coffee mug, whose result is number one in the automatic buy box? It's Amazon's coffee mug, 75% of the time. Even though Malaysian SMEs paid them a huge commission to list, and the Malaysian product may be cheaper and better. So under Malaysian competition law, maybe this is abuse of dominance. If Amazon has a dominant position and their algorithm is making their own competing products number one. So in some countries like India, they are saying, you know, the platform cannot also be a seller and so on. So the CPTPP e-commerce chapter helps to lock in the dominance of companies like Amazon in a number of ways. The first is that, as Dr. Bunga mentioned, it requires these cross-border data flows. So how does Amazon make its sales? 30% of Amazon's sales come from its recommendation engine. I have to admit, because I live in Geneva and the shops are all in French, I buy economics textbooks on Amazon. They're in English, right? And I put in an economics textbook, say, by Jomo, and it lists people like you also bought these books. And I think, oh, actually, this one, very interesting, and this one, and this one. I end up buying 10 because I'm paying the shipping anyway. So that is how Amazon makes 30% of their sales. They know at Idul Fitri in Malaysia, people like to buy this. Chinese New Year, people like to buy this. If they buy this, they also buy that. They have that because they have the data from the whole world, including Malaysia. And the CPTPP e-commerce chapter says that you must allow that data to go out. And the exceptions for legitimate public policy objectives, not arbitrary, unjustifiable, disguised restriction on trade, have a number of problems which we can talk about if you are interested. You can also schedule non-conforming measures, but you have to have them in the right sectors, and Malaysia did not have a horizontal one for e-commerce. So the other way that the CPTPP's e-commerce chapter can help Amazon's dominance is the source code provision. So source code is like software. It's a software that human beings can read. So how do we know whether Amazon is being anti-competitive and abusing dominance when it's their result, number one? Is that coincidence that it's 75% of the time, or is it something about their algorithm? Well, the Malaysian Competition Authority, MYCC, under Malaysia's Competition Act, has the authority to check anything, including Amazon's source code, their software, their algorithm, to see if it's deliberate that their one comes as the first result most of the time. That's allowed today under Malaysia's competition law. But it is not allowed under the CPTPP, because under the CPTPP, governments cannot check source code, except for critical infrastructure and patents. So Malaysia would have to change its Competition Act, and it could no longer check Amazon's whether Amazon is being anti-competitive in that way. And it also, of course, restricts the ability to require the transfer of source code. So if Malaysia, say, in the oil and gas industry, wanted to require technology transfer to Petronas or to any other company, and that included any software, Malaysia cannot require technology transfer if it includes any software. The only exception is critical infrastructure, and then patents, which is not relevant to here, it's more for my IPO. So, of course, we know technology transfer is one of the key ways to develop. It's how Norway developed their oil and gas industry, how Taiwan developed, and so on. But that's not the only way that technology transfer is restricted. Of course, in the CPTPP investment chapter, technology transfer is restricted on a negative list basis. So you cannot require technology transfer in any sector except those that Malaysia listed in its annexes 1 and 2 for technology transfer, and Malaysia only got that for a couple of sectors. The other thing, and so that can have an impact on business, but the other performance requirement that is restricted in the CPTPP investment chapter beyond TRIMS in the WTO is the ability to require the use of local services. So you can't require shops or hotels to use Malaysian accountants or Malaysian advertising companies or Malaysian cleaning companies, again, unless they are listed in Malaysia's annexes. And an interesting one that India used is the ability to cap the royalties that Malaysian companies pay to foreign companies. So, for example, how much royalties does Proton have to pay to Mitsubishi for the patents on its engine and its industrial designs? India, I think, capped them at about 5% to keep it affordable for local companies to get access to this foreign technology. Because otherwise, when you are bargaining with them, you know, you could be charged a very high royalty. You can no longer set a maximum royalty for these kinds of voluntary license technology transfer or technology agreements on a voluntary basis, say between Proton and Mitsubishi. Mitsubishi has to be allowed to charge as much as they want. And this applies to investors from the whole world, not just CPTPP countries. Again, on a negative list basis, so Malaysia could have scheduled exceptions to this in its annexes, but Malaysia does not have them for many sectors. And then, of course, the investment chapter is enforced through investor-to-state dispute settlement. So this allows CPTPP investors, which could include a US company who has an office in Singapore, to sue the Malaysian government for violations of the investment chapter. The original TPP also included the ability for investors from other CPTPP countries to sue Malaysia for violations of investment authorizations. I'm not sure that Malaysia does that anymore, but if MIDA said, I authorize you to come into Malaysia on condition that you employ Malaysians, and then there was a breach of the contract, basically the authorization. Under the old CPTPP, under the old TPP, the investor could sue for breach of that authorization and also investment contracts. So if the Malaysian government signed a contract with a Japanese oil company and then there was a breach of the contract, instead of going to whatever dispute settlement was in that contract, which might have been Malaysian courts, the investor can directly sue under the TPP. It via the investor-to-state dispute settlement, they could choose to go to the World Bank Tribunal. That part has been temporarily suspended in the CPTPP. The part that is still left for ISDS is that the investor can sue for any violation of Section A of the investment chapter, which includes the restrictions on performance requirements that I mentioned, but also things like fair and equitable treatment and indirect expropriation. So, of course, fair and equitable treatment, one of the interpretations of that has been a standstill on your laws and regulations. No new laws, no new regulations, no changing them if it harms the foreign investor. We don't know if that's what any ISDS tribunal would follow, but that is one common interpretation that is possible under the CPTPP that has occurred in other cases. And, of course, indirect expropriation, where you reduce the value of the investment, which is broadly defined to include the future profits they expected to make, their shares, their patents, any other intangible products, and so on, to the extent that it's similar to expropriation. So we know that in ISDS cases, investors have won 72% of the jurisdictional decisions, 60% of the cases on the merits, and there have been a lot of cases about things like, of course, health and environment laws, bans on toxic waste dumps, enforcing the law on foreign investors. So, for example, in Ecuador, an oil company broke Ecuador's law and breached the contract by transferring shares without permission, and Ecuador cancelled their license, as it was allowed to do under its law and the contract, and the oil company sued Ecuador under provisions equivalent to those in the CPTPP, and the company won, even though Ecuador was acting in accordance with their law. And Ecuador had to pay the lawbreaker $1 billion plus $500 million in compound interest, because the CPTPP allows unlimited monetary damages plus interest, which is usually compound interest and has been compounded every month from the date of the government action. And then, of course, even if the government wins 70% of the time, they have to pay their own legal fees, which is usually $1,000 an hour for lawyers. So I think the Philippines had to pay $58 million to the lawyers alone. That's when you win. So some of these ISDS cases have been about anti-corruption measures, for example, that India took when their 2G phone licenses were given corruptly and they were cancelled. The recipients of those fine licenses sued India under equivalent provisions to those in the CPTPP for their anti-corruption measures. So that is allowed under the CPTPP if Malaysia takes anti-corruption measures and the foreign investor loses their contract or their license or their permit or their profits are reduced and so on, they could also sue under the CPTPP's ISDS. So some people may think that this kind of investor-to-state dispute settlement at least encourages FDI. But according to the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development and the World Bank, it doesn't have an impact on foreign direct investment. In fact, foreign direct investment is driven by factors like your market size. China and India always get FDI. Whether you have natural resources, they will come for the oil and gas. Whether you have peace and stability, nobody's probably investing in Syria very much at the moment. Whether you have good infrastructure, does your electricity go off 10 times a day? Are your roads jammed? And whether you have human capital. So we see that countries who have withdrawn, in fact, from these treaties with these investment protections have not seen a drop in FDI. Brazil, I think, was the fifth largest recipient of FDI in the world when they had none of these treaties in force. And when you actually survey the general counsels of the multinational companies and say, do you check for these kinds of investor protections before you invest? They say no. When you survey the political risk rating agencies, do you check for these kinds of investment protections before you give a political risk rating? They say no. When you survey the political risk insurance companies, do you check if there are these kinds of protections before you give political risk insurance? They say no. So generally speaking, this has not been found to increase FDI, especially to developing countries. And of course, I think Malaysia's biggest foreign investor is the US, and Malaysia has no such treaty and protections with the US. So this is some examples. And then I just wanted to show you, there's some discussion that the CPTPP is the gold standard or the best practice. And in fact, the world has moved on since the CPTPP already. And especially in the e-commerce chapter, technology is moving so fast that some of the e-commerce chapter negotiators tell me the chapter was out of date before the CPTPP even came into force. And this is an example of exceptions to that source code provision that I mentioned, where the regulators cannot check the software, you can't require technology transfer if it includes any software. And you see in the CPTPP, the only exceptions to this is critical infrastructure and patents. Then the later trade in services agreement, 1 year later, some of the same countries, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Japan, realized they forgot an exception for competition law. And all the other times when now regulators need to check software, like car safety, gambling regulations, financial regulations, like high-frequency trading software, tax preparation software, cheating on emissions like Volkswagen, the car emissions scandal. And so they put a broader exception for legitimate public policy objectives, but you have to pass the chapeau of the GATT and GATS health and environment exceptions of not arbitrary, unjustifiable discrimination. Then the later free trade agreements by the EU, their proposals to Indonesia and so on, they also have a source code provision, but they realize this arbitrary, unjustifiable discrimination is actually difficult to pass. In the WTO, the easier version, which is restricted to same or like conditions, governments have only passed 1 out of 9 times. So the EU dropped that requirement to make the exception easier to use. And then they realized that legitimate does not cover competition law anyway. So they had to add an exception for competition law and intellectual property law and military procurement. Then after that, the USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or the new NAFTA, that's the most recent one, and they realized even legitimate is hard to satisfy because the WTO jurisprudence on this is widely used state practice, something many governments do. So the US said, okay, we want to make an even easier to use exception because this is going to have such a wide impact on our ability to regulate. So now the regulators can access source code for any reason, but only the regulators. So in Malaysia, I think you have discovery in court cases where the court can order the other side gets access to source code. And this is common in copyright infringement cases of software. You know, the allegations that Google said that Uber had stolen their self-driving car software. So the way that you see that is the other side gets the other side's software and they have a software that compares the software. And there's legal firms in the US who specialize in this. So it's not the regulator who's checking. It's the other side in a court case. There's no exception for that even in the new NAFTA, even though that's current US law. Similarly, in the US, the DNA testing software for criminal cases, there was a problem with it, and the court ordered, the New York court ordered it disclosed to the public so that all those who were wrongly convicted could challenge their convictions. Also not allowed under the new NAFTA. And the new NAFTA does not allow any of the transfer requirements for source code, which the US currently requires under their law. For example, in a merger and acquisition, say if Google and Amazon merged, competition was reduced so much that you order them to transfer their algorithm to a competitor like Lazada, let's say, or as a penalty for anti-competitive conduct, which is also allowed under US law. So this is just an example of one provision and how since the CPTPP, actually, governments like the EU, US, Mexico, Canada have realized that the CPTPP did not give them enough exceptions, even for their current law. So they have been fixing it in subsequent agreements. But the CPTPP has not been reopened. This provision has not been suspended. It's still there. And you only have the exceptions for critical infrastructure and patents. So in this way, I would say that the CPTPP is no more the most gold standard or best practice, say, for example, in this provision. And similarly, under the Trump administration, they removed almost all of the investor-to-state dispute settlement in the new NAFTA. There's a legacy for 3 years, there's some for Mexico, but generally speaking, there's no investor-to-state dispute settlement. So is that the new gold standard? Then what does that leave us with in the CPTPP, where you still have investor-to-state dispute settlement, even though the US has left, and it may have been the US who was insisting on it, including for pre-establishment rights in national treatment and MFN, restrictions on performance requirements, and so on, including free movement of capital with capital controls exceptions, but that take 2 pages of conditionality that you have to satisfy. So it's not very easy to use them, and it's not clear to me as a lawyer that they would save the kinds of capital controls that countries may need in a financial crisis. So, yeah, that's it. Thank you.